Blog Talk Radio.
This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show live here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash, or not live in the archives if you're listening later than 4 p.m. on the East Coast. Hope you are having an amazing, fantabulous day, as am I. My name is Kyle, and I will be taking you through the next hour-ish, a little less than an hour, here on the Take It Easy radio show on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash, which you can subscribe to on Blog Talk Radio and follow on Facebook and Instagram. Also, you can find us wherever you find podcasts and follow us at Comical Sports Memes and Take It Easy podcast on Instagram. So we've got a fun show planned for you today. We've got some live baseball going on. The Boston Red Sox went from down 0-3 to 3-3 against the Minnesota Twins. We'll see how that one plays out over the next 50 minutes or so. Just before coming on, I talked before about how research goes. This is I usually spend like about a half hour before the show kind of looking at interesting topics, researching things that I found interesting. It's especially important on a Thursday when we've already done the topics I've been ruminating for a week on Wednesday. And so we find new topics for a Thursday show. It becomes especially important at that point. And I just found myself during that time watching a walk-off by the Atlanta Braves, Dansby Swanson, against the Miami Marlins, and watching my San Diego Padres put a victory together against the Pirates. And I want to talk about that one. Again, I just wanted to throw out the love for the walk-off, because how often do you get to see a walk-off unless you have MLB.tv? Let's talk about the Padres for a second, because I realized something over this last week that's fascinating from just being a sports fan, and it's just like an experiment in being a good or a bad sports team. Is just the Padres have never been good. At least in my memorable lifetime, the Padres have never been good. And so the Padres are now really good. There was no like middle ground where they're like mediocre or slightly above 500. The Padres went from really bad, fourth, fifth, in the NL for my, or NL West for my lifetime. Never better than third post-2010. The Padres for my, from, let's see, 2010, I would have been nine. So from age third grade, what would that be, nine? From age nine, third grade, to graduating high school, the Padres were just bad. Just bad baseball. Actually, technically last year was the first time they were good, and that didn't start till July. So third grade through sophomore year of college, the Padres were bad. And now, all of a sudden, the Padres are good. And something I've learned from this fandom, and we'll talk probably more about this tomorrow because it's Dodgers week, is the Padres are now expected to beat up on crappy teams. And that is so fascinating to me as a fan, that you now just expect to beat up on a bunch of crappy teams every single time you play them. So that's been really fascinating to see, is that you have a 7-game set with Texas and Pittsburgh, two of the worst teams in baseball. I could easily make the point that Texas is the worst team in the National League and that Pittsburgh is the worst team in the – oh, no, wait. Texas is the worst team in the American League and Pittsburgh is the worst team in the National League. They're not exact replicas. They're not exactly the worst because the Baltimore Orioles and Detroit Tigers still exist. But they are really bad. Like, point blank, they are really bad. And the Padres come in, you just like you expect to win 5 out of 7 games. And in baseball, the difference between 4-3 and 5-7, or 4-3 and 5-2. So winning 4 out of 7 or winning 5 out of 7 is a huge difference. Like, considering the worst teams in the history of baseball still manage to win 1 out of every 3 games in a series, it's a major difference between being 4-3 and 5-7. And the Padres always go into, like, series against the Pirates where you're just like, all right, it's cool if we can win 2 games in the series. And you come in now against Texas and against Pittsburgh where you're just like, yeah, we expect to win the series. And sweeping is obviously in the realm of possibility. And then they just go out and do it. And they throw a no-hitter to kick it all off. Like, it's a huge part of it that I've never realized before, is that being a great team means you just beat the living daylights out of a bunch of bad teams. And that's something I've never experienced until a little bit last year, and last year was obviously a shortened season, but in full this season, when you play 7 games against Texas and Pittsburgh before leading right into Dodgers week. And boy, am I excited about Dodgers week, the first one of this new epic rivalry that has gotten baseball fans far and wide uber into the baseball, like new Yankees Red Sox and Dodgers Padres. You can see I'm having trouble talking about it. It's just so damn exciting. The new Dodgers and Padres rivalry replacing the old Yankees Red Sox rivalry, even though the Red Sox are better than the Yankees this year. This, ladies and gentlemen, is going to be fun. So that's what I was ruminating on during my 30 minutes of prep time, and used it to kill about 10 minutes of a podcast. So, or not a podcast, a radio show. Used to saying podcast, then stopping segments and restarting segments. A little bit of a force of habit, and FOH. I like saying FOH because FOH stands for something else, but it's just a little FOH. So what I wanted to talk about was following up really on a story that we talked about last Wednesday, and we dedicated most of the podcast to last Wednesday, and that is this story of the University of Arizona basketball, the changing guard of the NCAA. We talked a lot about the scheme. I hope if you've been listening that you check out that HBO documentary, The Scheme. It is absolutely fantastic, and it gives you a great insight to what the NCAA is at its truest and truest core. This is what the NCAA's practice is all about. And we'll get to this when we talk about the FBI investigation around Arizona. But the first thing I want to talk about is the Arizona basketball search, because when they fired Sean Miller, I think there was a reasonable expectation that they had someone in mind that they wanted to hire. And it turns out that their first pitch was to call Eric Musselman at Arkansas, which was never going to happen because Eric Musselman is waiting for the best of the best jobs to open up. Arizona, sorry to say it, they're kind of at a lower tier than Arkansas right now. So I guess Arizona, when they fired Sean Miller, didn't really look in the mirror all that well and think where they are as a franchise right now. They were the main forces of the FBI investigation, and one of the things we talked about last week is Arizona, the University of Arizona Wildcats, they were 5-time Pac-12 champions in 8 years with Sean Miller, 5 Pac-12 titles, 5 Sweet 16s, and 3 Elite Eight appearances. The Arizona Wildcats, after the news broke of DeAndre Ayton's $100,000 payment on wiretap and Sean Miller going on administrative leave, went after Sean Miller's reinstatement, lost in the first round of the tournament to Buffalo. They were a 4 seed. Lost in the first round to 13 seed Buffalo. 9th place in the Pac-12. 5th place in the Pac-12. 5th place in, or 6th place in the Pac-12. So they went 9th place, 5th place, 6th place in the Pac-12. No tournament appearances. Sean Miller gets fired. And they still have the FBI investigation pending on them. Not the FBI investigation from the FBI standpoint, but from the NCAA standpoint. Again, we'll get to that in a bit when we talk about USC. So Sean Miller got fired. They were looking for that coaching search, and we talked about how the changing landscape of college basketball revolves around the transfer market, and lo and behold, 4 Arizona players are entering the transfer portal. 2 more are looking to see if they'll enter the transfer portal but could return. 1 player who is already scheduled to come to Arizona after transferring from Eastern Washington may not go to Arizona. And, oh, by the way, they have 1 more player who is waiting to see who the new coach was. And lo and behold, we have the new coach. And his name is Tommy Lloyd. Had I ever heard of Tommy Lloyd before this? No. But do I hear of a lot of these coaches who get hired? Not exactly, but I hear about them a little more than Tommy Lloyd. And here's the reason why I hear about these incoming coaches more than I hear about Tommy Lloyd. And we'll get to that when we talk about Cincinnati, because that story at Cincinnati is just insane. But it's also awesome. So Tommy Lloyd, the reason I didn't know a lot about him is because Tommy Lloyd has never been a head coach. Tommy Lloyd has never been on a March Madness run. Like this guy from UNC Greensboro, I believe his name is Helms, if I remember correctly, or West something. But anyways, he had never been on a long run. He had never been in conference tournaments. There is Wes Miller. That's who it was. Sorry, not whatever I said it was. It's Wes Miller was the coach at Cincinnati. So Tommy Lloyd, the coach, the new coach at Arizona, had never been on any Final Four runs. He had never been to a Cinderella run in the tournament. He had never, you know, like Porter Moser, who's now at Oklahoma, he had never been to a March Madness and, like, had the head coaching Cinderella name, like the guy from North Texas or Shaka Smart when he was at VCU. Tommy Lloyd was the lead assistant for 20 years behind Mark Few at Gonzaga. And this is actually kind of a typical coaching hire. Like, this isn't the strangest thing. It's like the best, the number 2 behind the number 1 is usually the one in line to get the new job. In Tommy Lloyd's contract at Gonzaga, he was literally written into his contract that he would be the successor to Mark Few one day. He's in his mid-40s. Mark Few is currently 58 years old. But they had written into his contract that he would succeed Mark Few at Gonzaga when the day came. And he was big in the international recruiting cycle. He got guys like Tarzewski and Kelly Olynyk and Ronnie Turioff and a bunch of these guys from the international route to Gonzaga. But guys, sometimes you're just not willing to, you know, wait it out all the way through. Like, a better job opens up. Yes, you're next in line for the Gonzaga job, but you know who else is next in line at a big school? This guy in the 90s at North Carolina this is the first North Carolina. When Dean Smith retired, he took over. He got 3 years and got fired. So it's a guaranteed future job, but when you get offered a better opportunity, you have to take it. Case. There's 2 perfect examples of this. Jeff Cable, he was the guy who was next in line behind Coach K. He was Coach K's lead assistant for about 15, 20 years. He was next in line to succeed Coach K. And ultimately, he turned down Coach K to take the head coaching job at Pittsburgh. He's still there 5 years later. He's still coaching at Pittsburgh. For how long, we'll still see. But he's there at Pitt now. Mike Hopkins was the coach of Syracuse, or I'm sorry, he's the second coach behind Jim Boeheim at Syracuse for about 18 years. And ultimately, instead of waiting for Boeheim to retire, he ended up taking the head coaching job at the University of Washington, which again is just one of those situations where it's a job you couldn't really refuse. And for Tommy Lloyd, yes, you're next in line at Gonzaga, but that guarantees you 4 years as a head coach at Gonzaga. Why not take the chance at Arizona, a school that used to be a perennial basketball powerhouse? Like, recently they've been to a number of Elite Eights. It's a damn good job to have, not at this time. This is kind of their, like, their plan D hire, because, again, when we talked about this with Passner and we talked about it with Eric Musselman, those were names that came up right away. Arizona is not that desirable of a job right now. The reason why is this pending FBI investigation. Hanging over Arizona's head is an investigation by the NCAA that we don't know when it will conclude. Now, they may have gotten a hint on this from what just went down at USC. Because when the scheme went down, some of the assistant coaches that went down with Christian Dawkins were at USC, Oklahoma State, Arizona, but Arizona was another thing, and then LSU, who was caught on the wiretap from an FBI investigation when they went deeper into the cell phones of Christian Dawkins. So those were some of the schools who got busted over the FBI wiretap situation. And Arizona is one of those schools that, because they have Sean Miller on tape, Arizona got in some trouble with the $100,000 thing that we're still waiting to see what their postseason ban or sanctions or whatever it might be. Well, USC got their notice of sanctions this afternoon, and USC is getting a 2-year probation with no postseason ban. So the school's going to basically get away scot-free, because probation doesn't hurt your recruiting and or transfer portal cycles. So they're going to get off okay from this, which is funny, because at the time the FBI investigation was like, we are going to rein in college sports and identify these problems and get some coaches in trouble. And ultimately, all it produced was like a 2-year probation for USC. Some assistant coaches got, you know, penalties by the law, like criminal records and doing community service. One guy went to jail, obviously Christian Dawkins, the head person, the head honcho behind this story. And the documentary subsequent afterwards tells a great story of, you know, race in the justice system and what that did for Christian Dawkins. And so this is the difficult part of the story, is that one of these runners goes to jail, some assistant coaches plead, you know, guilty or whatever it might be, and plead guilty to whatever type of accepting bribes they're talking about at public institutions, which is the crafty way they got that behind the law in order to get a conviction. But the University of Arizona is one of those schools right at the top. And by the way, Oklahoma State over this, who was part of this, they got a 1-year postseason ban, and they're appealing it, which is why they were able to play in the postseason with Cunningham this year. So they'll probably get that next year. But Arizona knows something is looming over them. They just don't know what it's going to be. And so Arizona has that going on. It's not the most desirable job in the world. And I'm sure that there's an understanding for our buddy Tommy Lloyd that this is such. It's why he got a 5-year contract with Arizona, which was the largest contract the Arizona Board of Directors was allowed to give to a head coach. So they gave Tommy Lloyd 5 years as like a bridge, like, we understand that this is going to be a weird process in between, and that this is all about a rebuild and recruiting, and we might be bad coming up here because we have the NCAA investigation looming over us, because 4 of our players are transferring, and because 3 more might be transferring. This is a difficult situation, and we understand how this is playing out. Yet, we also recognize that we are the University of Arizona. We're a pretty desirable job, and we were able to pull in Gonzaga's lead assistant as a coach, which, and this is where the story gets more interesting over last week, was not popular among the Arizona player base, the Arizona alumni of the school, who, you know, they made a championship run in 2001 and made another Final Four with guys like Gilbert Arenas and Richard Jefferson, who went on an Instagram Live video. And when a comment brought up about Richard Jefferson, I wish I had this clip available, but when they talked about the Arizona job, Richard Jefferson said that's already a debacle enough. And then him and Gilbert Arenas, also Arizona teammate, were talking about this Arizona job, and Gilbert Arenas talked about how players don't want this Tommy Lloyd guy to be the coach. They want one of these former alumni to be a coach because they're, you know, obviously it's the brotherhood and they're going to support the brothers that are, well, I don't know why I said that like a gringo, but they're going to support their guys and they're going to support a player getting the job. And Gilbert talked about, you know, Pastner wasn't really available, but he's a former U of A guy. Mark Pope at BYU wasn't really available. He threw out Damon Stoudemire, who built a nice little program at Pacific. Now, he hasn't had huge winning seasons at Pacific, and it's damn near impossible to make the tournament from Pacific because you play in a conference with BYU and Gonzaga. So that just makes life infinitely more difficult coming out of the West Coast Conference. And to have, you know, job bounce upward from job mobility, Damon Stoudemire, for those who don't remember, was like the heart of the Jailblazers and played like 13 years in the NBA. So those are the guys the alumni was talking about, and Tommy Lloyd was not a popular pick because he's an assistant coach at Gonzaga who's big on the international circuit. And international can sometimes be code word for white dudes. And this is a big part of the Arizona basketball landscape, is that they want the program to be an alumni-based thing. This wants to be a community, like kind of like what Miami has in football, where players come back, and this is like UCLA kind of had that in basketball, but also there wasn't a lot of interaction with the players around Mick Cronin. Now, Mick Cronin happened to be a nice guy, and Mick Cronin happened to turn people's minds around pretty quickly. A Final Four run helped quite a bit, but I'm talking about even before then. Mick Cronin turned the players around quite a bit, and Tommy Lloyd can do that too. It's just going to be interesting to see what kind of leeway he has there, and it's already off to a bad start if that's where the University of Arizona is right now, because these guys aren't suckers. Richard Jefferson is not a sucker. Gilbert Arenas is not a sucker. I forgot the other guy who was talking about this story and how alumni were not exactly happy with the situation. And so this is an interesting place. And by the way, this is also with the football team at Arizona, because Arizona hired a guy from the Patriots to come be their coach. And it was like the quarterback coach of the Patriots ended up being the head coach. And it's interesting to see how the University of Arizona is going about this. But it's still interesting that, you know, players and like Arizona players and alumni are not exactly happy with this move. And so this is the difficult place that Arizona finds themselves in, where, you know, they could have gone after Luke Walton if he had been fired already by the Kings, or which kind of sucks for him because he probably would have been in a nice little position there. But it's a really difficult place. They could have had Jason Terry, another former Arizona guy who's been an assistant coach with Sean Miller. Like, they had a bunch of options there. They didn't work out all that well, but they still had lots of options available to them. And to end up with Tommy Lloyd feels like it's a decision at the top, which of course is a decision at the top, but if it's unpopular now, he's going to have work to undo it. Like, this is not a super uncommon thing, is that administrators get the guy they want, which for some reason is Tommy Lloyd, for whatever the reasons might be at the top, why the president of the university really wants Tommy Lloyd. Your guess is as good as mine. I don't really know the answer behind it. But it's just interesting to see that juxtaposition between what the University of Arizona players are looking for, what the administration wants, combined with a school that is already fading to the background because they got hit the hardest by this FBI wiretap thing. And it took away Sean Miller's run. And Sean Miller, I don't think very many people are feeling bad for Sean Miller, but I always subscribe to the idea that everyone's got something. And for Sean Miller, that's got to suck that this is how your tenure, probably as a coach in college basketball, comes to a close. I know, like, Tom Crean and some guys went on the rehabilitation tour and got another job. But if this is it for Sean Miller in the college ranks, and now he wants to go be an NBA assistant coach, like, that's a bitter pill to swallow. That's a bitter way for it to close out. And that's, like, the FBI thing being the thing that ends up leading to your downfall and making your school like a black sheep that, you know, forces U of A to fire you 5 weeks after the season ends with no March Madness appearance. That's a tough sell. Like, if you're Sean Miller, that's just a tough break on your part. So he'll go coach in the NBA at some point as, you know, second lead assistant, or maybe, you know, 5-6 years from now, he'll work his way back to the college ranks as a Kelvin Sampson style return where he's no longer a black sheep. And so after a half decade in the NBA, he'll go back to college at some point at like a University of Houston or even a school like a, I don't know, what would be a school in there? Like one of these Mountain West schools, like what Steve Alford is doing, where he got a 10-year contract from Nevada to be their head coach. Maybe that's the route that Sean Miller goes down to as his rehab tour is, NBA for a bit before working his way back to college ranks. But it's got to be a bitter pill to swallow if you're Sean Miller. And that's the interesting thing going on at Arizona, as it appears that their school is watching as college basketball passes them by a little bit. But we'll see what Tommy Lloyd can do as a head coach. It's just a fascinating, fascinating story. And it's like college hiring processes are always so amazing because of how many different incentives go into it. They're always fascinating stories, like always fascinating stories when you go through this hiring process. Let's talk about the Cincinnati thing real quick, because this is like, if you want to talk about the equivalent of player empowerment, and this is kind of just, again, sports reflect society. So this is a big thing with organized labor right now in our country. And organized labor in the private sector is a big part of, you know, the conversation around what college basketball is at this point. That's what shamateurism is built on. So this is a reflection of society. One of the really, quite frankly, the only power sometimes that labor has over mandating change is restricting and withholding your labor. And when you have leverage, like an elite college basketball player has the appearance of leverage, they don't have leverage or power, they just have the appearance of it, you can use that appearance and that threat to your advantage, which brings us to the University of Cincinnati, because whether intentionally or unintentionally, the players at that school who played last season got their coach fired, which is fascinating to watch play out. They got their coach fired. So this guy got 2 years post Mick Cronin leaving for UCLA. That never happens. You never, ever see a dude get fired after 2 seasons in college basketball. Like, something had to go horribly wrong to get fired in 2 seasons in college basketball, where guys get, like, 5-year contracts. They get, like, 5 years just to right the ship. So something had to go horribly wrong here for Cincinnati. And I don't know the reporting behind it at this point. I know there's been some done about why players were so unhappy at Cincinnati. But the mass exodus of players entering the transfer portal forced Cincinnati 4 weeks after the season ended to fire their head basketball coach and replace him with the guy from UNC Greensboro, who we were talking about earlier. It was West something. But he was the guy whose name, like, came into focus because he was the person who was – oh, there we go. We're back on. Sorry. Had a brief pause there for a minute. But he was the guy who was – He was the guy who was in contention for the job at North Carolina. And people said, like, he's more qualified than the person who's taking over the job, Hubert Davis, which was just code word for white-black, because Hubert Davis is a black man coaching the North Carolina team, the first one ever. It's very real who's in charge at the North Carolina basketball program. There was a lot of code being thrown around on that one. But Hubert Davis ultimately got the job, and so Wes Miller, the coach at Greensboro, was making his exodus, making his move, and he found a nice landing spot to move to at Cincinnati. Like, North Carolina felt like it was way too much of a step up for him, considering just how desirable that North Carolina job is. Like, if Hubert Davis flames out in 4 years, that North Carolina job is going to be hugely desirable from a coaching standpoint. Like, that's one of those jobs that Eric Musselman starts to consider when talking about everyone wants to hire him away from Arkansas. That's one of those jobs that Musselman starts to consider. But anyways, this is the interesting place that the University of Cincinnati found themselves in, is that they had to fire their coach because all the players were leaving. And when six players use that leverage of the transfer portal and the one-time transfer rule that has now changed the entire landscape of college basketball for the better, it's just made it different and forced schools to adapt or die. It's why Roy Williams wanted to retire. It is a leverage play that everyone's going to leave and go play somewhere else. And the University of Cincinnati said, we have no choice. Because not only are they leaving, they're explaining why they're leaving, is that there's a problem with the university. By organizing the movement that all six transferred on the same two-day period, that is a sign that there's something there, and the coach just got fired. They tied the hands of the university and said, look, we've got no scholarship players. All of them are leaving. You can bring in new ones. It's going to be a process to rebuild, and this is why they got this guy from Greensboro and gave him a four-year, five-year contract with Wes Miller, is that this is going to be a long rebuild, and Wes Miller is going to recruit some people over to the University of Cincinnati. By the way, if you're wondering, Wes Miller, so they made the tournament this year and 2 years ago. One of their teams from 3 years ago had Jared Butler on the Greensboro team, who just made a first-team All-NCAA at Baylor. So that is what he was working with there, is that he found Jared Butler as a diamond in the rough, and Jared Butler moved over to Baylor and became first-team All-NCAA. So Miller's going to recruit some people, reset this program, maybe get some transfers in there, but they were dying out there when everyone transferred. It's one of the most G moves I have seen from a, like, player-using leverage standpoint, or at least the illusion of leverage, is that they got the coach they didn't like fired at Cincinnati. Even if those players are still going to leave, it's still a leverage play that should exist. That is no longer the illusion of power, but creating legitimate power, where the players organized, six transferred within a two-day stretch, and the coach got fired at Cincinnati after two seasons. So because it was only two seasons, and because it was 4 weeks after the regular season ended, we can draw a direct line between the Cincinnati job opening up and those players using a flex to get their coach fired, which is just awesome. It's awesome to see, at the very least, the illusion of power being used to get something that they wanted, or at the very least, to instigate some sort of change at the university. And to be honest, I have a feeling Cincinnati is going to be better off making this move. If the coach was fireable at that point, they probably were better. If the coach was so bad that they all wanted to leave and get him fired, then Cincinnati's for the better moving on from the coach. Like, this is going to be better for Cincinnati in the long run. But it's also the players just disillusioning the university into doing something that changes things up from what apparently was a bad situation at Cincinnati. Again, don't have the reporting behind it, so I'll be a little journalistically credible and say I'm not sure why they wanted to do it, But at the very least, it gives my heart a little bit of joy knowing that there is a little bit of power in there for basketball players and college athletes making a ton of money for the university under shamateurism that they cannot profit from. So it just warms my heart a good little bit to see something good like that come out of this story of the FBI investigation and for things to start looking up for Cincinnati and college athletes getting some rights. And if they can't get compensation, it's baby steps in the right direction. The changed rule about total one-time transfers is a step in the right direction, no question about it. Baby steps. That's how you can look at change. You can look at change observable over a long period of time. And in this case, you can see the change from where we were 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and where we are now in terms of the transfer portals, the ability for players to use leverage, and even get a coach fired in the case of the University of Cincinnati. The final one, and we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, was the USC thing, and I'm just fascinated that from that entire FBI investigation, that entire run of an FBI investigation that was supposed to crack down on college athletics, it was supposed to crack down on college coaches getting bribed, even though it's not exactly how the system works. Ultimately, you got a couple postseason bans from the NCAA and some probations, and that's just about it. And it's kind of funny to think about it in the grand scheme of things. I've talked about this before. I encourage everyone to check out the fantastic HBO documentary, The Scheme. It is a great, great piece that kind of details these sides of the collegiate basketball story and these weird sides of the bribery that wasn't bribery, but also got the legal system messed up and then a crazy case with some FBI agents who were misappropriating taxpayer dollars and how they were maybe going to go on trial and how it was all just a giant runaround by a guy named Marty Blazer to get some guys in trouble and expose a problem that wasn't a problem in his efforts to avoid jail time. It was a really fascinating story that I encourage everyone to check out. But again, you've got maybe something coming for Arizona, but other than that, you've got 1, 2, 3 years of probation and 1 year of postseason ban that came out of what was supposed to be the craziest scandal in the history of college sports. And that's kind of all we got. So, with that being said, what is up next on the docket here? Well, first of all, we can do our natural transition here where the Minnesota Twins, we talked about them earlier, nice little walk-off, except everyone's wearing 42, so I have no idea. Is that Max Kepler? Looks like Max Kepler hit the walk-off for the Minnesota Twins. So congratulations, Max Kepler. Congrats on that amazing victory here today. So, yes, good on Max Kepler for hitting some sort of walk-off to help the Twins beat the Boston Red Sox, who aren't actually that good, but worked out pretty well for them. Yeah, Max Kepler walk-off hit for the Minnesota Twins. Congratulations to the Twins on beating the Boston Red Sox, who are like 7-4, but they'll come back down to earth at some point. Most of these baseball teams are only separated by a couple games, so Boston will fall back down to earth as the season starts to progress. Because, of course, they will. Boston's not actually that good. Baseball's kind of weird that way off the bat of the season. So let's talk LaMarcus Aldridge for a quick second. LaMarcus Aldridge has retired, and it's a sadder note because it's health ramifications. So that is – it's obviously crazy. And LaMarcus Aldridge is probably not going to get in the Hall of Fame, but he probably should. He's in this weird place where he's one of the top 100 scorers in the history of the NBA, 15 years, legendary moments, all-star games, the whole nine yards, multiple deep playoff runs, not just as the number one on those Portland teams, but then as the number two on the San Antonio teams. They obviously didn't win anything together in San Antonio, but LaMarcus Aldridge has had an amazing career, and it's sad that this is the way it ended, like midway through a playoff run, with the Brooklyn team that looked like they were just going to coast their way to the finals. And by the way, Brooklyn might actually be better in terms of floor spacing without LaMarcus Aldridge. Not saying that they're a better team, but I'm saying a replacement-level player would have kind of done them justice at this point. So just a tough break for LaMarcus Aldridge. But it's probably good that he was on Brooklyn at this time because it seems that the situation tended to work itself out. And so that is the end of LaMarcus Aldridge's run, and he is retired as an NBA player, which, again, it's always sad when there's medical parts behind it. Sad, but also, like, joyful that LaMarcus Aldridge is okay and has this perspective about what being an athlete is. And hopefully this is his decision that he's come to terms with, and this isn't, like, being forced into a retirement, even though the scary medical event in question happened 5 days ago. So this is a tough, tough part of having a regular heartbeat and a rare condition with an extra node that shocks your heart, which obviously if your heart's getting shocked electrically more than others is that you get shocked over and over and you have you get shocked a bunch. And so you have all of a sudden irregularities in your heartbeat and you have to take medication. But this time it was a little scary for LaMarcus Aldridge, but this is the tough part about whatever, you know, Chris Bosh and something similar, but it's a tough, scary part that they just, you can't be medically cleared to do it. So I hope that this was his decision that he had come to terms with and not something that kind of forces him into retirement because, obviously the mental health ramifications of it are a big deal because post-career depression is a very real thing in sports because for a lot of these people, this is how you associate your personality. What you do, and this is just a human thing, is that what you do often comes to define who you are. And this is the difficult part about being, we talked to Chris Cluey, the former Vikings punter, about this. And who you are doesn't have to define who you are, but when you spent your entire life from like age 9 or even younger, like age 7 to age 32 being a basketball player, it's hard to, or in the case of LaMarcus Aldridge, 36, it's hard to be something else. It's hard to find that next thing. It's hard to pivot unless you've been considering, like, basketball doesn't define who I am, even if it's been what I've done for 25 years of my life. And this is the thing I figure out with, like, talking on the radio and doing podcasts and things like that. It doesn't define who I am. It's just what I do and what I want to do because I love it so much. And this is the difficult part about separating self from this idea of being, you know, a basketball player as your identity, but not, it's just the thing you do and not who you are. So I hope LaMarcus Aldridge came to terms with this and realized that, you know, he's not just a basketball player, that there's some sort of pivot. And this is, Jay Williams talked about this. I was listening to his book recently, and one of the interesting things he brought up that I remember as my Sam Hinkie three things I picked up in 45 minutes is when you're a basketball player who has, when you left without a degree and you retire and maybe you don't have the great degree, the only thing you're qualified to be at a certain point is a bodyguard and a coach. And so this is the tough thing about being in this industry and pivoting is because there's only so much that you are qualified to do. And so, you know, talking about being a business person or an agent or whatever it might be, there's this difficult journey that, you know, doors will open up for you and you're looking around an industry and seeing like, yes, this is my opportunity and breaking through the door here has opened up these other doors within the sports industry. And so life becomes a nice little path to remain in the sports industry, pivoting to whatever direction it is that you might go. But it doesn't make you qualified to do other things, even if that's what you so chose. And this is something I subscribe to a lot, is the idea that we have different stages of lives. We live about 6 lives within the various lives that we have here on Earth. And so this is the weird place that we find ourselves in is just we are all, what's the best way to phrase this? We are all in this position where we have to pivot at some point in our lives. Because we can't just be the same person that we were 50 years ago. We can't, like, things adapt. Things change at a rapid pace. And so we talked about this when we were talking about college basketball earlier, but again, sports reflect society at large. Things are constantly changing, so we have to constantly change with it. Sometimes that means taking a full pivot, changing the industry that we're in, taking a leap of faith, jumping scared or whatever it might end up being. You have to take these different leaps of faith going forward. And so this is the difficult thing with having multiple lives and also being underqualified for something, is that sometimes you have to restart your life at 36 when you've had millions and millions of dollars and you have a family like LaMarcus Aldridge does. But a lot of these people have families. It's an awkward stage of life where you have to pivot for whatever you're going to be. Maybe it's being a dad and a coach, because that's something you're qualified to be. Everyone's qualified to be a dad. And then, unfortunately, everyone's qualified to be a dad just by having a child, but you're qualified to be a dad and you're qualified to be a basketball coach because you've been playing basketball for a quarter of a century. You've been playing basketball and you've been surrounded by basketball. So this is the tough place that you find yourself in with post-career depression, because you have affiliated yourself and your self-worth and your self-identity with sport for your entire life, from child to now whatever stage of life you can no longer play your sport professionally is. And that is a tough road to change to if you've already kind of put yourself in that position. Like, this is who I am. I am the star basketball player, but what happens when basketball is taken away and you have to pivot to something else? Have you set something else up? Do you want to go back to school? What is the game plan? And that's something not everyone has the answer to, and that's perfectly okay. I don't have answers myself, and a lot of people don't have the answers. Sometimes it just comes through the process of finding yourself, having a vision and pursuing it, and then you can change the vision and the path along the way. But as long as you have a vision for what you're searching for, I think you're going to be generally happier and generally on a better path, whatever that vision might end up being, even if it's as a coach or a bodyguard, because that's what you're qualified to do. Just kind of the way those things start to roll. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping into the Take It Easy radio show here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. We will be back again next week, but in the meantime, check out both of our episodes this week, as well as Game Chat, Russell Talk in the D, and all kinds of great shows here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. Find us everywhere that you get podcasts at Take It Easy. And ladies and gentlemen, with that being said, take it easy. We'll talk to you again next week. It's been a pleasure being with you for the past 2 hours over the past 2 days. Take it easy.